You're out in your cab alone. To you waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening and welcome to Prison Pipeline. My name is Emma Lugo and I am a co-host here at Prison Pipeline. Tonight we have on a very special guest. We have two very special guests on. We have Paul Wright from the Human Rights Defense Center. And Paul's going to be speaking with us about COVID-19 and the U.S. prison system. We're going to be talking about infectious disease control and the spread of COVID-19 within the prison system, and what we can do to fight it and prevent it. And we've also got on Fury Young. Fury Young is with Die Jim Crow, which is a music label dedicated to incarcerated persons, poets and rappers and musicians who are currently incarcerated. So we're going to start with Paul Wright. So Paul, welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for being here. And then we're going to talk with you, Paul, for about 10 minutes, and then we're going to go over to Fury and bring Fury on, and then we'll have both of you for the last 10 minutes of the show to kind of just talk kind of open forum. Paul, what's going on right now with COVID in the U.S. prison system? Can you tell us about that? Are there any cases that have popped up yet in the United States? And what are prison officials doing right now? And what are activists doing to deal with this issue?
Well, so far, I haven't seen any reports yet about COVID being of any known cases of COVID at this point in American prisons. I saw some news reports that there have been reports of COVID infecting prisoners in Chinese prisons. But I think that one of the things that's important to note is that prisons, especially American prisons, have long been vectors of disease, especially infectious diseases. We just reported in Prison Legal News how in January of this year, there's an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease at the federal prison in Coleman, Florida. And over the years, pretty much almost every infectious disease outbreak, from drug-resistant tuberculosis, drug-resistant strains of HIV, many of these drugs, Legionnaires' disease, MRSA, our prisons are literally breeding grounds and almost like incubators for these contagious and infectious diseases. And basically it comes down to very simple explanations, as lack of sanitation, a lack of very basic medical care, and crowded living conditions coupled with poor sanitation, poor ventilation. And this has ensured that prisons literally are sources of disease around the country. And the notion that that because they're prisons and because they're isolated, that they aren't really affected by these diseases is kind of a misnomer, because the prisoners may not be going anywhere in and out of the facilities, but the staff are. And typically what happens is that the prisoners get infected, the prisoners are sick, they're the ones that have the diseases, and then the staff take the diseases out of the prison and into the community with them when they leave their workplace each day. And this has been going on for literally centuries, and it has not changed.
I think that when I think about what's happening with COVID-19 right now in the United States and how it's starting, it's just be, beginning here. And I think about what happened with H1N1 and how, do you remember when H1N1 came out about 10 or 15 years ago and how that,
yes. Mm-hmm.
And it seems like there's lessons. There was an article in The Hill. I normally wouldn't refer to The Hill, like, you know, but there was a really good article 2 days ago in The Hill, like talking about 4 things that we can do to help protect people who are incarcerated. And I would like to say, first of all, that the most important thing that we could do to protect people who are incarcerated is releasing them, especially all of the people who are unjustly incarcerated, who are serving long sentences that are completely unnecessary, serving sentences and mandatory minimums, and people who are just really jailed unnecessarily, including people who are jailed down on the U.S. border. And, you know, that's the first thing that we could do to deal with the health of these communities. And then, of course, as you just said, if we provided adequate health care, you know, adequate sanitation and adequate living environments that were not completely crowded and isolated, that would be ways that we could obviously address it. But going back to the H1N1 flu, which passed through the United States and, you know, had a huge impact on the U.S. prison system. Can you refer to that? Maybe just comment on lessons maybe we've learned from that could be applied to COVID-19?
Yeah, some of the bigger lessons that we've found is I think that the basically the pretty much almost total neglect and lack of basic health care in our nation's prisons, and especially in our jails. Jails in some respects are even worse because prisoners are coming and going literally 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They're coming in and out of jails. And one of the things that what epidemiologists in this country have long argued that the criminal justice sector is an ideal place for public health intervention, where doctors and epidemiologists can actually thwart the spread of a lot of diseases. Like, put this in the context, depending on the state, anywhere between 40% and 70% of the prisoners are infected with hepatitis C. And despite this, prisons rarely, if ever, provide treatment. They have to be sued to provide treatment for hepatitis C, even though there's treatments that can cure it. One out of every 4 people that are HIV infected will pass through a prison or jail in this country in the course of a given year. And again, these are opportunities to give people treatment to ensure they can get health care. And yet, universally, prison and jail officials refuse to do so, providing very minimally constitutionally adequate care, if at all. And I think that part of the problem is that prisoners and arrestees are generally viewed as an expendable population. No one in our government really views this as a population where, even for the sake of the entire citizenry and the sake of the public health of our country as a whole, should receive medical treatment or should be treated for potentially infectious diseases, if nothing else, so that more people can't be infected. And this has been an ongoing issue for literally well over 100 years, and unfortunately, it's quite the disgrace. And I think the United States is alone among industrialized nations in taking this position, but is also alone among industrialized nations of not having a public health care program.
Mm-hmm. So the lack of an adequate public health care program for all citizens in the United States is reflected in the lack of adequate health care within the prison system.
Yes, I think that's probably a fair statement.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people who don't have adequate health care may end up in the prison system because of co-mitigating factors.
Exactly, and I think that in some respects, I think that, you know, the excuse for not providing prisoners with much in the way of medical care meets with the response of, well, law-abiding citizens don't get health care or medical treatment when they need it. Why should prisoners? And, of course, you know, the response to that, too, is that, well, I mean, put prisoners in a cage, you've deprived them of the ability to seek any type of medical care on their own, so at that point the state's responsible for it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's literally the government in this country uses that as an argument that you know, to use it to cut both ways is, you know, we're going to put you in a cage and deprive you of the ability to seek medical care. But because we put you in the cage and deprived you of that ability, we shouldn't have to give it to you because people we haven't caged yet may not be able to access medical care on their own either.
Paul, the organization you're with is the Human Rights Defense Center. Can you tell me about that for just a quick minute, and then we're going to go to Fiori Young for about 10 minutes?
Sure. Yes, I started the Human Rights Defense Center in 1990 when I was in prison in Washington State. I started publishing a magazine called Prison Legal News, which folks can find out about at prisonlegalnews.org. And we started out reporting on news and developments around detention facilities and prisons and jails and prison and jail struggle. And over the past 30 years, we've steadily grown. We now have offices in Seattle as well as Florida and Washington, D.C. And in addition to publishing Prison Legal News, we also publish another magazine called Criminal Legal News, which reports on criminal law and procedure and policing. And we also publish and distribute books related to prisoners' rights and prisoner issues. And we also do litigation and advocacy on behalf of people enmeshed in the criminal justice system. And we do things, and we litigate and advocate nationally, not just in Florida where we have offices. And over the years, we've done a lot in Oregon. We've sued the Oregon Department of Corrections and the Umatilla, the Columbia County jails over their policies banning publications. And we have a lawsuit pending in Oregon involving the Multnomah County jail's practice of handing out debit cards from people that have been arrested. They take their money, and when they're released, they give them debit cards and then charge them fees to access their own money. So this is some of the stuff that the Human Rights Defense Center has done in Oregon over the past 30 years.
Thank you so much, Ray. Can you hang on, Paul, and we'll have you on in about 10 minutes to kind of close
absolutely.
Out the show with Fiori?
Sure, absolutely.
Great, thank you. Our next guest is Fiori Young and Maxwell Melvins. Fiori Young helped produce the record label Die Jim Crow, which focuses on incarcerated persons. Welcome to Prison Pipeline, Fiori. I'm sorry, Fiori, can you hear me? Yeah.
Hey, sorry about that, yeah.
That's all right. Welcome to Prison Pipeline. Sorry, can you hear me, Fiori? Oh, we just lost them. Darn it. Okay. We're going to go back to Paul. Paul, let's continue our conversation about COVID-19 for about 5 minutes, and then we'll see if we can get Fiori on for a few more minutes after that. So one of the things that I'm really concerned about right now with the spread of COVID-19 within the general population is how will it be treated? How will it be approached within, maybe with your understanding of the prison system? You might help us paint a picture of how the government will respond to the inevitability of COVID-19 entering the prison system somewhere. One of my first concerns is that, you know, the population will be put on lockdown, which is incredibly cruel. I mean, the United States Supreme Court has ruled on this, and it's only to be used in the most extreme of conditions. But one of the things that The Hill argued in its article, and again, I will not usually refer to The Hill, but this was a good article, was that the response needs to be uniform, across systems. So one of the things that's going on right now is there's about 1 million people in the United States that go through some form of incarceration every month. Most of it is just DUI arrest. But this overwhelming number of the general population coming into prisons and then coming out of prisons, coming into jails, going into county jails, going into prisons, and then coming out, and with the staff, this is really going to be an issue. And the Hill is basically arguing that there needs to be a uniform approach.
And I agree with that. And I think that one of the problems that I think will be uniform is I think that more likely than not, prisons and jails will treat this with their customary neglect and indifference. And what could be either something could be mitigated and minimized will probably wind up getting worse and be aggravated by generally the lack of the lack of any concern for the health and well-being of the prisoners. And I think that one of the things we should also talk about is that one of the things that is, if not causing these problems, at least aggravating them, is the rise of for-profit medical care providers in our nation's prisons and jails. And these are companies that I call them the HMOs from hell. And they have a very simple business model, which is to get as much taxpayer money as they can from the government and then to provide as little services as possible to the prisoners that are being hired to treat medically. And we see this here in Florida, for example, in the time period that within 2 years of the prison healthcare system being privatized, deaths, for this for a prison system with around 100,000 prisoners, the death rate went from 35 to 40 prisoners a year for medical reasons to 400 to 500 prisoners a year for medical reasons.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, I mean, this, these are like numbers are like death camp proportions. I mean, you know, 0.5% of the prison population in Florida is dying of medical neglect.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the same people that, you know, one would expect to, the same people running the prison system are the ones that we're expecting to actually craft some type of response to an epidemic. And I'd say that especially to the extent that you have these companies, these private companies, whose literally their bottom line, their profit margin depends on not providing that medical care. It depends on not providing medical care treatment, much less preventive treatment, to prisoners who get sick and get infected, despite being paid to do just that by the government. So I think there's this confluence of factors that, that I think is probably going to, if and when the virus arrives or strikes into our nation's prisons and jails, I think it's probably going to be as bad as everything else has been in the past. And mm-hmm. This includes Legionnaires' disease. This includes MRSA. I mean, just to put this in context, right now our nation's prisons are awash in MRSA.
Yeah.
And this is a very simple disease to prevent. It just requires basic sanitation and hand washing. And prisons and jails can't even provide that very basic and simple preventative measure. And then we factor this in with a lot of other diseases that routinely coexist in our nation's prisons, right? With hepatitis C infections, HIV, tuberculosis. And there's also nutritional issues. I mean, prisoners aren't being fed in a way that ensures they have healthy and strong immune systems.
Or getting enough exercise. Things, yeah.
Or lack of exercise. I mean,
yeah. And the crowded conditions.
There's nothing about how our nation's prisons are run or operated that is designed to ensure either a healthy prisoner population or, you know, a proper epidemiological response. The thing is, I don't think there's anyone in the medical profession that I think would claim otherwise or argue otherwise.
Well, thank you, Paul, so much. I really appreciate it. I think we're going to let you go now, Paul, and we're going to close. We're going to do the last half of the show with Fiora Young. So thank you so much, Paul, from the Human Rights Defense Center. And if people want to find out about that online, where can they find you?
They can go to our website, www.humanrightsdefensecenter.org. or prisonlegalnews.org or criminallegalnews.org. They can also find us under those names on Facebook and Twitter as well.
Thank you so much for being on Prison Pipeline.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you. Our next guest is Fiora Young from Diagem Crow. Fiora helped start a label in 2013 that was dedicated to formerly incarcerated and currently incarcerated poets, rappers, hip-hop artists, and has an amazing, amazing label, an amazing collection of people that he has helped to bring their stories to the community. Fury, welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Hey, you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine. Thank you so much for being on the show. Fury, can you tell us a little bit about what is Diagem Crow?
So Diagem Crow is the first nonprofit record label in the U.S. has devoted to recording formerly and currently incarcerated musicians. And I started the project back in 2013 as an idea for one album, which was like a concept album about the U.S. prison system and racial injustice. And over the years, I got access to several prisons and several incarcerated collaborators and met several formerly incarcerated musicians, one of whom I'm have the honor of sharing this call with. Shout out Maxwell Melvin, who I believe is on the line as well.
Maxwell, welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Yes, hello. How are you? How are you doing?
Good, yes, thank you. Yes. Maxwell, can you tell me your story? Tell me a little bit about your story and about Jim Crow.
My story, all right. Well, my name is, as you said, Maxwell Melvins. I'm an original founder of the hip-hop group, the Lifers Group, out of East Jersey State Prison, which was formerly known as Rahway State Prison. I was a part of the Scare Street Project. And, you know, I came up with the concept since hip-hop music was so big out there at the times, and our kids were listening to it, that we would possibly do an album or something to be able to reach those kids. So we actually did. We got a great response, and the project actually got nominated for a Grammy against Peter Gabriel, Sinead O'Connor, and Billy Joel. Of course, Madonna walked away with the Grammy, but I didn't even anticipate winning a Grammy. That wasn't why I set out for the project. I set out to really turn some lives around and save those lives. You know, over the years, as I said, you know, I come into contact with Fury Young, you know, who I understood had done some music with a few prisoners and everything, was working on a great project. So the two of us got to met together to meet. He's done us several stories on me, and I became a part of the Die Jim Crow project. I'm actually the senior advisor to Die Jim Crow Records, in which, you know, it had the same aim, goals, and objectives as the Lifers Group had. And we want to change, what we want to do is change the prison narrative through music, meaning providing for people to tell their stories with their own words, right? Not the media or anybody telling their stories, with their own words. We wanted people to be able to tell you what is going within, their own words and their own voices, of what their prison experience is, of what the injustices that are going on throughout the system. There are so many, with the mistreatment in every aspect. And just a way of them also share their story, which could be of help to deter and help others, so that they wouldn't follow down the same path that many of us have chosen to run down. And as he said, you know, I think the Die Jim Crow Project was a great, great project, and I'm honored, actually, to be a part of it, be able to contribute to that, because we are having an impact on many. As I said, we are changing the lives one day at a time of many, because music does change lives. And we don't just do hip-hop. You know, he does folk music, R&B, because I know, as you mentioned earlier, you said basically hip-hop. No, we don't just focus on hip-hop. Die Jim Crow focuses on all forms of music, from bluegrass to R&B to hip-hop to any form of music is what we do. And, you know, the thing about it that's so great, we have so many artists.
You do.
People
can you tell
me? Jim Crow. When I say artist, I'm talking about visual art. I'm not just talking about the art of music. I'm talking about visual art, paintings, all forms of art, the people that are a part of Die Jim Crow. And we are very blessed and thankful that we are able to be that bridge and that outlet for them to be able to share their stories and tell their stories from behind these walls, because no one is telling their true stories for them. So again, what the Die Jim Crow Project does, it allows them to tell their own stories in their own words, with their own voices.
That's
so
amazing.
That is a great thing.
Thank you so much, Maxwell. Thank you. Thank you, Fury. Well, tell me about some of the artists on Die Jim Crow. I was looking over your website, Die Jim Crow, and it's an amazing collection of artists you have. Mostly men of color who are currently incarcerated and had just incredible stories to share. Can you tell me about some of the people that you feature in Die Jim Crow, Fury?
Yeah, absolutely. So we work so far. We've recorded in 5 different prisons, and they've been in Ohio, Colorado, South Carolina, which was a women's prison. At one of them was, or is, and one juvenile prison in Mississippi. And we've worked with a lot of incredible artists. So far, we've put out an EP, which was mostly recorded in a prison in Ohio called Warren Correctional, and the main artists were Mark Springer, Anthony McKinney, and Charles Boyum. And they just delivered a lot to that EP, they were kind of like the groundwork of it. And then we finished the album with formerly incarcerated artists in Brooklyn and Philly, such as B.L. Sherrill and Apostle E. Lois and Pastor Anna and Yvette Edouard and Carl Duke. And the project kind of started from there. And then I got, like, publicly, that is, I had been working with people in prison, writing letters and building up for the EP and so forth prior to that. But that was, like, the big launching moment publicly, you could say, for the project and our first musical output. And then since then, I've gotten access to these three other states and have had the honor of working with some great musicians at Colorado Territorial Correctional, which we're going to actually be releasing an LP of those recordings in August. It's like folk and rock and blues, and it's really, really good stuff. And then we've recorded in two prisons in South Carolina with an artist by the name of B. Alexis at a women's prison there, and God just, yeah, God with a J, and then B-E, to curse. It's really epic, and yeah, it's crazy stuff, so that's going to hopefully be out soon, too. But we got a lot of amazing artists, and formerly incarcerated artists, like our deputy director, B.L. Sherrill, is dropping her first album on May 8th. Maxwell Melvins is going to be one of the executive producers on the Lifers Group 30th reunion EP, which will drop next year, so we got a lot of good stuff in the works.
That's amazing.
And Shirley, you mentioned something. You mentioned something that was very important. You said that we do a lot of work with mostly men of color, or something. That's very important that you said that. You noticed that many of the artists of color.
Oh, I didn't
do you
say
recall that.
That?
No, you didn't know. He said that. The host said that.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, I'm sure he would know the reason about that and why there are so many men of color, because that's one of the foundations that Die Jim Crow stands on, for the injustice and inequalities that are going around, that is just mostly affect black men and men and brown people of America.
And it's women just, as well, of course.
And women.
And we work with black women, many as well, in addition to men. But yeah, you're absolutely correct, Maxwell.
So that was very important that, you know, he mentioned that, and, you know, he asked why, that he noticed that, and I was explaining why. And I was explaining that, yes, that is also one of the foundations of the Die Jim Crow Project, for to allow those artists and people to describe and tell their stories of the injustices and inequalities that are directed towards mostly people of color.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, definitely. Just to piggyback off that, when I did start the project back in 2013, I did intend to make an album that was very much inspired by Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, and was about racial injustice in the U.S. prison system. And I was pretty much exclusively working with black artists, men and women across the country. So then the project expanded over the years. And, you know, we work with artists of many different backgrounds now, still predominantly African-American. But, we work with folks all over, and what everything, just echoing what Maxwell said about the disparities, because that's still a very real thing, of course, in our...
Thank you. Fury, so we've only got about 1 minute left on the show. Can you just tell us really quick, where can people find you? And we'd love to have you back on Prison Pipeline in the future, maybe next month or after that. I'd love to have you on for a full show, and maybe we get some music samples from you. But for right now, if people want to find out more about Die Jim Crow, I know you're speaking at the Prisoners Family Conference this upcoming week, but if people want to find out more about Die Jim Crow, where can they go?
So you can go to diejimcrow.com, and you can also check us out on Facebook and Twitter at diejimcrow, Instagram and Twitter, and then on Facebook we're also just /diejimcrow, and check us out. Please follow us, support, donate, anything helps.
Thank you, Maxwell.
And look out for our first drop, too, on May 8th, the debut LP from B.L. Sherrill, Asada Troy, will be dropping, so check that out, too. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Maxwell Melvins and Fury Young of Die Jim Crow. And we will try to get you back on Prison Pipeline next month. So thank you so much for being on tonight.
We will definitely be looking forward to it.
All right. Thank you. Have a good night.
Thank you very much for the privilege.
Thank
you. Do the same.
Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
KABU Community Radio will be holding a volunteer orientation on Tuesday, March 3rd from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. The orientation will be at the station, 20 Southeast 8th Ave, near East Burnside. For more information, you can log on to kboo.fm or send an email to volunteer@kabu.org. See you there!
KABU is hiring. We're currently accepting applications for our volunteer and outreach coordinator position. We're looking for someone with experience in volunteer management and outreach to diverse communities and preferably has experience with nonprofits. This is a full-time position. For the full job description and instructions on how to apply, see the job listing on our website at kabu.fm/employment. Applications are due Saturday, March 22nd by 5 p.m. KABU is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Up next is Hard Knock Radio.